Welcome to the Practical Employment Law Podcast, a podcast covering all aspects of American employment law. I'm your host, Mark Chumley. It's time again for an update on the latest in labor and employment law developments. To remind you, updates are all based on recent cases that have been decided, new laws that have been passed, and general news from the world of labor and employment law. Before we get started, a couple of housekeeping matters. First, regular listeners may have noticed that the music has changed. I thought it was time to freshen up the podcast, and I hope you like the new music. Drop me a line and let me know what you think. Second, I have a New Year's resolution, and it is to be more consistent about podcasting. My goal is to do one topical episode per month, plus one update episode. So, in keeping with my new goal, this is your January update. Let's start with the always entertaining Elon Musk and his company SpaceX. Those of you who follow the labor and employment law news may have noticed that Mr. Musk's companies are frequent flyers with the various federal agencies that enforce labor and employment laws. The most recent litigation involves a complaint issued by the NLRB accusing SpaceX of illegally firing 8 employees who had circulated a letter in 2022 criticizing Musk for issuing inappropriate, disparaging, sexually charged comments on Twitter. The interesting thing about this case is that Mr. Musk apparently decided that the best defense is a good offense. Earlier this month, SpaceX filed its own lawsuit against the NLRB, arguing that the agency's structure violates Article 2 of the Constitution and the 5th and 7th Amendments. The lawsuit argues that because only board members and administrative law judges can be removed by the president, not all employees, the agency's structure is unconstitutional. The lawsuit also argues that the NLRB proceeding denies SpaceX its right to a jury trial, and that the NLRB exercises all 3 constitutional powers, legislative, executive, and judicial, in the same administrative proceedings, which is unconstitutional according to the complaint. Now, this is a very broad challenge to administrative authority because most agencies exercise all 3 constitutional powers, legislative, executive, and judicial, to some degree. Interestingly enough, Trader Joe's is now making similar arguments in another pending NLRB case that it is facing. Now, I should point out that these kinds of arguments were raised and shot down back in the 1930s when the NLRB was created. However, if we have learned anything in the last several years, it is that the current Supreme Court is willing to revisit historic precedent that was once considered to be carved in stone. In the last episode, I mentioned the pending challenge to the Chevron doctrine that could significantly alter how agencies operate. Well, this is essentially another existential challenge to agency authority, and I, for one, cannot wait to see what happens. Next, let's look at a retaliation case from the Western District of Texas, Johnson versus Federal Information Systems, Inc. In this case, a discharged employee brought a Title VII suit alleging retaliation, among other things, against her former employer, a software company. The employee's development team held daily virtual meetings to discuss progress on the project. At one meeting, the employee reported that some of her automated tests were malfunctioning because of recent software updates. She proposed reverting to the prior software, but was instructed to update her tests to accommodate the software changes. Afterward, she told her supervisor that she felt she was not being heard because she was a woman. The supervisor reported this comment to the project manager, who told the supervisor to include him in all subsequent team meetings. The project manager did not report the employee's comment to anyone else. At a meeting 2 days later, the employee and the developers were trying to determine why approximately 600 of the employee's automated tests were not working. She again argued that the software should be changed, not the tests. After consulting with the master developer for the project manager concluded that the only feasible solution was for the employee to update her tests. 8 days later, the employee was discharged for poor work performance and because her position was being eliminated. The court found that the employer's proffered legitimate reasons for the discharge, poor work performance, and elimination of the position were supported by the record. Also, the evidence showed that her position had in fact been eliminated. In considering whether there was any pretext for retaliation on the employer's part, the court concluded there was no evidence that the director of operations, who ordered the termination, had any knowledge of the employee's protected activity. He only learned of the employee's comment to her supervisor about not being heard after the termination. The project manager to whom the complaint was made had not reported the comment to anyone, but conducted his own investigation and concluded that the complaint was meritless. This is one of those cases where the stars aligned just right for the employer. Initially, it might have been best if the project manager had reported the complaint to Human Resources and there was a full investigation. But the takeaway here is that in these kinds of cases, the devil is in the details, and here the decision maker, the director of operations, did not even know about the complaint, so he could not have retaliated. So this one worked out for the employer, but if he had known about the complaint, it would have been a different case. Next, let's consider Ledesma versus Orland Park Wedding Center out of the Northern District of Illinois. This case presents a fairly common scenario in my experience. An employee of a bridal store told her manager about her mental health conditions during her employment. And later, she told her employer that she needed to be hospitalized on the recommendation of her therapist. The employee provided 6 days' notice to her employer that she needed to be hospitalized for 1 to 2 weeks, and her manager responded that she needed to be at work instead. The store owner asked for medical documentation of her absence. When the employee returned to work 10 days later with the requested medical documentation, the bridal store's owner and manager did not review the documents and immediately terminated her employment. The employee sued for disability discrimination, retaliation, and failure to accommodate. The employer attempted to get the case dismissed, but its motion was denied. This is pretty straightforward and a textbook example of how not to handle this kind of situation. First, the employer was plainly aware of the need for accommodation since the employee had disclosed her condition and the need for a leave of absence. At this point, the employer needs to engage in the interactive process and discuss possible accommodations. Here, it looks like the only possible accommodation would be a brief leave of absence. Barring undue hardship, that really needs to be granted, and a leave of this duration is not going to present an undue hardship in the vast majority of cases. The bottom line is that if an employer becomes aware of an employee's need for an accommodation, whether or not they specifically ask for one, they need to engage in the interactive process. A good rule to follow is that if an employee raises a condition, particularly a mental health issue, the employer should respond by asking what the employee needs from the employer to be able to do their job. The head-in-the-sand approach is never a good strategy, and terminating an employee immediately after their return from a leave for a medical condition without an ironclad reason is not going to end well for the employer. As a sort of counterpoint to that case, let's look at Galette versus Avenue 365 Lending Services from the Eastern District of Pennsylvania. Now, this case involved a funding specialist for a title company. Her duties included printing, scanning, and dispersing checks, releasing wires, facilitating the timely funding of loans, handling files dispersed by third-party partners, handling mail, answering emails and phone calls, overnighting checks, booking or posting wires and deposits, and performing wire confirmations. During the pandemic, the company's employees began working remotely. Later, the employee was diagnosed with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD, and emphysema, and although the company required its funding specialist to return to the office in July, the employee was permitted to continue working remotely based on a medical accommodation. Due to a change in company policy regarding remote workers, however, and the need to mitigate the threat of financial fraud, checks were no longer permitted to be scanned or printed remotely, and remote workers were not allowed to mail checks, release wires, book deposits, or receive and handle return checks and mail. In late 2021 and early 2022, the financial market slowed dramatically and the company required remote hires who lived within a reasonable geographic proximity to return to the office. Throughout 2022, it implemented a hiring freeze and conducted several rounds of layoffs. In January 2022, the employee requested a permanent work-from-home accommodation, which the company rejected. Instead, it offered her a handicapped parking spot and a private office. Although she provided a doctor's note in support of her request, she was terminated when she failed to return to the office. She filed a lawsuit claiming disability discrimination. The primary issue in the case was whether the employee could perform the essential functions of her job with or without a reasonable accommodation. She testified that there was nothing the company could have done to accommodate her return to the office. She could not walk more than 100 meters, and even with a private office, she would not have been able to store her oxygen tanks. The company argued that the essential functions of her job included, among other things, printing, scanning, and dispersing checks, and releasing wires which could not be performed remotely. Remote funding specialists were only permitted to perform three of the job's essential tasks, answering emails, making phone calls, and handling attorney wires. The court in this case sided with the employer, noting that the employee was effectively asking her employer to accommodate her by permanently removing essential job functions or by reallocating those functions to others. The court noted that the ADA does not require employers to accommodate a disabled employee by permanently assigning essential job functions to other employees. This case is a good reminder that while employers are obligated to offer employees accommodations, they do not have to alter the essential functions of the position. The employee here did not suggest an accommodation that would have allowed her to perform the essential functions of her job, which was the fatal flaw in her case. Unlike the prior case, it appears that the employer here did engage in the interactive process and offered an accommodation. The ADA does not permit an employee to make unlimited demands or changes to their job duties, so in this case, the employer prevailed. Finally, let's briefly revisit the PUMP Act, which is an acronym for Providing Urgent Protections for Nursing Mothers Act. I covered this a while ago, and you may recall the basics. The PUMP Act, which went into effect last year, provides that for 1 year after a child's birth, covered employees may take reasonable break time each time such employee has a need to express milk. An employer may not deny a covered employee a needed break to pump. The frequency and duration of breaks needed to express milk will likely vary depending on factors related to the nursing employee and the child. Also, covered employees must be provided with a place other than a bathroom that is shielded from view and free from intrusion from coworkers and the public, which may be used by the employee to express breast milk. A bathroom, even if private, is not a permissible location for the employer to provide for pumping breast milk. The Department of Labor Wage and Hour Division is in the process of publishing industry-specific guidance for compliance with the PUMP Act. Earlier this month, the DOL published guidance for the restaurant and retail industry that includes a recorded webinar, presentation slides, and FAQs, frequently asked questions, that provide examples tailored to the restaurant and retail industry. The DOL previously published guidance for the agricultural industry, and there was a recent webinar covering the transportation industry, although the materials are not yet available on the website. Next month, there's a webinar scheduled for the education industry. I will include a link to these materials in the show notes, and if you are in one of these industries I mentioned, it would be worth reviewing the materials. This has been the Practical Employment Law Podcast. Thanks for listening. Please watch for future episodes wherever you get podcasts, and if you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and leave us a review. If you would like to contact me about any aspect of the podcast, my email address is mchumley@kmklaw.com, and my full contact information is in the show notes. This podcast was created for general informational purposes only and does not constitute legal advice or a solicitation to provide legal services. Although we attempt to ensure that the podcast is complete, accurate, and up to date, we assume no responsibility for its completeness, accuracy, or timeliness. The information in this podcast is not intended to create, and listening to it does not constitute an attorney-client relationship. Listeners should not act upon this information without seeking professional legal counsel.